break. No, we're just gonna, oh yeah, IT is after that, okay. Mr. Tanner, do you want to take your exhibit?
Oh, thank you.
The next matter on the calendar this morning is in the trust, in re the trust of the Charles W. J. Curry Trust. And it also involves the trust of Phyllis A. Curry. Council, when you're prepared, you may proceed. Please identify yourselves for us when you reach the podium. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Julia Nierengarten. I am here on behalf of petitioner Janet Curry. This case is about trustee Charles Curry Jr.'s mismanagement of his parents' trusts through repeated failure to follow the express terms of those trusts. The parties do not dispute the relevant terms of these trusts, nor do they dispute that the trustee did not follow some of these terms. This mismanagement resulted in a decrease in the value of the trust and damaged the trust beneficiaries in ways that would have been avoidable had the trustee followed the express terms. The district court made extensive findings, including findings that the trustee did not follow the express terms, yet it did not come to the corresponding conclusion that the trustee breached his fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries of each trust. This refusal—
May I ask you?
Yes.
Is there a difference between breaching a fiduciary duty and breaching a trust?
Our position is that breaching the trust is a breach of his fiduciary duty, particularly in this circumstance where the question is whether he followed unambiguous terms of that trust instrument. So under the law, the trustee derives his authority from the terms of the trust itself. He has certain obligations to follow those terms, to manage the trust in accordance with the intent of the settlor, to manage the trust for the beneficiaries, for the benefit of all beneficiaries. And in this case, when we're talking about trust terms that are unambiguous, the parties don't dispute what they say, and the actions of the trustee deviate from those trust terms, in fact, expressly violate those trust terms, that violation of the trust constitutes a breach of his fiduciary duty because he has failed to limit his actions to the authority conveyed upon him by the trust instruments.
With regard to the largest amount of money at issue here that involves the distribution from the father's trust to the mother's trust each year, the 5% or 5,000, I assume it was 5%.
Yes, it was somewhere between $80,000 and $83,000 for each of the years that it was processed.
Well, mother had an absolute right to request that distribution each year. And you're taking issue with the fact that there wasn't a cross T and dotted I, I mean, in a sense, that there wasn't a written request by her to make that distribution each year. Am I correct about that?
Correct.
But didn't she, in fact, know about that distribution that enabled her to make the gifts that she made?
Well, that's what the trustee has told us, and that's what the court ultimately concluded. However, that doesn't excuse the failure to comply with the prerequisite requirement of the trust to request that withdrawal in writing. And the reason for that is twofold. One, as I said, it demonstrates that intent by the settlor of the Charles Trust, Charles Curry Sr., his intent that the withdrawal would only be made under this prerequisite writing so that it wasn't, you know, an automatic, it wasn't a discretionary withdrawal. It was when she made the request in writing, she was entitled to take 5,000 or 5%, whichever was less. But the second reason it's important, particularly in this case, is that it would actually have created...
Wasn't it whichever is greater?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misspoke. Correct. It was whichever was greater. So $5,000 or 5% of the principal balance of the trust, whichever is greater. I apologize.
No, that's right.
The second reason it's important here is because it would have created demonstrative evidence showing that Phyllis' mother was... involved in and specifically requested these types of withdrawals to be made from the Charles Curry Trust.
But if the court, I mean, you need to, whether it's a breach of trust, breach of the trust terms, and leave aside, and that's a breach of trust or breach of fiduciary duty as an overarching concept, you still always need to show that the breach, I assume, that there was a duty, that there was a breach, that damages were caused by that breach.
Correct.
And here, if the court found that mother, who had an absolute right to make the withdrawals, knew of the withdrawals, that there was no damage to either trust based on the lack of writing, what's the argument then that some different outcome should result? It seems like you're not challenging the court's factual findings. And so the court, I believe.
Correct.
So factual finding 22 that finds that there was no injury or damage based on a lack of writing, and then earlier findings talking about that mom, in fact, intended the withdrawals.
Well, so
why doesn't the claim just fail right there?
Because the damage, first of all, the damage is to the beneficiaries of the trust, right? So the Charles Trust required the writing to make the withdrawal. Otherwise, the entire principle of the trust was to go to the remainder beneficiaries upon Phyllis's death. When the trustee starts processing these withdrawals without the requisite writing, he's depleting the principal balance of that trust and therefore ultimately reducing the total amount of the principal that the beneficiaries will take upon Phyllis's death. Now, none of this mattered until Phyllis, none of this was, you know, particularly relevant, I should say, until Phyllis decided in 2009 to change the beneficiaries of her trust. Because before that point, the beneficiaries of each trust were the same. So this intent to draw down the Charles Trust to give gifts while Phyllis was alive, monetary gifts to the family, would have had no practical impact on the beneficiaries because they would have taken equally from each trust. But when Phyllis decided to change her beneficiaries from what had originally been in equal parts to the three children or their issue to, I believe it was 35% to Janet, or it was either 30 or 35% to Janet, 35% to the trustee himself, and then the remainder to his family. I believe the original amendment was 30 to each of them. Then it became detrimental to the beneficiaries of the Charles Trust, who included people who were not beneficiaries of the Phyllis Trust. So when they're drawing down the balance, the principal balance of the Charles Trust for the purpose of preserving the principal balance of the Phyllis Trust to go to those beneficiaries, it's prioritizing the Phyllis Trust and its beneficiaries over the Charles Trust and its beneficiaries to the detriment of those beneficiaries.
But are you saying that that mother could not have done that, even in writing?
She could have done it in writing.
Absolute right to choose to do
if
that.
If she did it in writing.
So it's just the absence of the writing that you're claiming caused the harm.
Correct.
And even though she could have done it without the writing, and she, in fact, presumably intended to do it.
Well, our position is that she couldn't have done it without the writing. She could have done it if she had requested it in writing, we would, you know,
right.
We wouldn't be here.
Right, she could do it including for that purpose.
Right.
Yes. But because there was no writing,
right.
You're saying she couldn't, well, I guess my point is the court pretty much thought mom would have done the writing. She intended to take these withdrawals for exactly this purpose. Her only failure was not to put it in writing. And that, you're saying, causes the harm then.
Correct. And so this writing thing, this writing requirement sounds very much like a technical requirement that obviously the district court didn't find to be fatal to the defense on a breach of fiduciary duty. But the thing about the requirement is that it was unambiguously stated in the trust that it required a writing before a principal withdrawal could be made. And that's particularly important in light of the fact that the trust was initially drafted in 1991. And at the time it was initially drafted, it had a professional trustee as a successor trustee to the Charles Trust. He amended it in 1997, I believe, to change the trustee to be his son. So at that point, he changed it from an institutional trustee, a professional trustee, to a family member, layperson trustee. But he did not change the requirement that she needed to request the withdrawal in writing. He could have done it at that point, and he didn't, which indicates that whether we think it's too formal now is not reflected in the trust itself, because he had an opportunity to change that requirement when he also changed the trustee of his trust. Because if it was too formal as between family members, and he recognized that and he thought that was a change to make because it wasn't going to be a formalized process with an institutional trustee, he could have, and if he had placed value on that, would have done it at that point.
If I could, while you still have time, I just want to ask a question about relating to, you know, what are the damages on the
Correct.
Two other breach of the terms of the trust.
Correct.
So with regard to the $38,958 in the income withdrawal,
yes.
Do you agree that, well, that was restored or corrected, and so that they're not damaged, this is the flow from that?
There were damages that flowed from that. And then the district court required that they be disgorged from the Phyllis Trust.
So
our position is that by requiring that, the district court recognized to some extent that there was damage that.
So there were damages at one point, but they're not now. I'm trying to understand your position on this.
I, to be honest with you, I don't know for sure whether those have actually been disgorged. I assume that they have been, and to the extent that they have been, you're correct that would not currently be damages remaining on that.
And I had the same question on the compensation of $30 an hour from the Phyllis Trust. You know, was that, you know, which I understand you're saying that violated the terms of the Phyllis
mm-hmm.
Trust. Was that restored, or is that, are there still damages you believe that flow from that?
My response would be the same. To the extent they've been disgorged from the trustee back into the to Phyllis Trust, there would not be damages on that anymore.
So are those harmless errors?
Well, it's not harmless error when he disregards the express terms of the trust and demonstrated an understanding of those terms when he previously...
What makes it, on the latter two, where the court, in fact, ordered restoration of the funds,
mm-hmm.
what makes those errors that you're alleging
again
harmful rather than harmless?
They violate the express terms of the trust.
I understand that you think it's error.
Right.
And let's assume that. Why is that... Why isn't it harmless if, in fact, the remedy was achieved?
Because the ultimate, I mean, had he not made these explicit, engaged in actions that were explicitly violating the trust terms, for instance, we wouldn't have had to expend time and energy on the litigation to unsort all of it. I mean, he was the only person who was managing the trust at the time the income transfer was made. And therefore, to the extent that it was a mistake, he made no effort to correct it until he was ordered to do so by the district court.
So are you saying this really goes to your attorney's fees argument?
Yes. I mean, in part, yes. And also, the attorney's fees, as much as the trustee should not have been permitted to pay his attorney's fees out of the fund, out of the trust, His defense of his actions in these cases was a defense of his explicit violation of those trust terms. You know, there wasn't a question about what they meant. It wasn't about whether he had the discretion to, for instance, with respect to the principal withdrawals, it wasn't whether he had the discretion to, as he saw fit, to distribute principal to mother and then... We're fighting over whether he properly exercised that discretion. This is whether he followed the requirements within the trust for processing the principal withdrawals, for processing income transfers, and for paying himself out of the trust. Each of these issues was expressly addressed by the trust terms, and he expressly acted contrary to those unambiguous terms.
How did your client find out about the $36,000-plus transfer from Charles' trust to Phyllis's trust after Phyllis's death?
I assume it was through either. That's a good question.
Well, if it's not in the
yeah,
record,
I don't know the actual answer to that question. All right. I can guess, but I don't. Okay. I personally don't know the answer to that question.
So the remedies that you're seeking on appeal is the restoration of the principal amounts that were withdrawn without a writing, presumably,
correct,
and then a remand for the district court to reconsider attorney's fees decision, both with respect to payment of the trustee's fees and with respect to your client's
correct
fees.
I think your questions have addressed most of what I plan to address on my own, so if you have any more, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise,
no.
Okay.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Teresa Bevilacqua, and I represent the respondent, Charles Curry Jr., who is with me today in the courtroom. Also with me for the argument was Ms. Towns, and she is my colleague. We tried the case together in Dakota County. And that is where I'd like to start. What has been argued in this appeal is not what this case was ever about. What the case was about from the beginning was a belief by the petitioner, Janet Curry, that undue influence was exercised over her mother with certain changes that were made in 2009 to Phyllis Curry's estate plan. And that is how the case was presented at trial. That's what the discovery focused on. And that was the primary allegation with respect to breach of fiduciary duty. Your Honor had asked a question about whether there could be a breach of trust separate from a breach of fiduciary duty. And I want to talk about that for a moment.
Well, that exactly wasn't my question.
I'm sorry.
I don't understand the distinction in the legal research that I've done.
Yes. And so you could, a trust is a contract. It's a legal document. You could have a technical breach of that legal document without it rising to the level of a breach of fiduciary duty.
And what case law would I look to for seeing discussion about that?
And I think the best case, it's not very fleshed out in the opinions, Your Honor, but I think the best case is the In re Margulis case.
Okay, I've read both of those.
Yes, and I think that's the best one where it talks about if you have a trustee, and this happens often, especially with lay trustees, people who are not professionals, they're not bankers, they're not accustomed to being a fiduciary duty, they may make certain errors in their accounting or their administration of a trust.
Okay, well, let me ask you this about this case.
Yes.
Because this is what intrigues me about this case. With respect to the $36,000 transfer that was made from Charles' trust to Phyllis's trust after Phyllis's death, which the court, and there's been no challenge to the court's decision that was improper under the terms of the trust, it has to be returned, and the $6,000 in fees that the trustee paid to himself after Phyllis's death, those have to be returned. There's no challenge to that. With respect to the fact that I don't know if we'd know about that, or we certainly wouldn't have a court order ordering the return of those fees without the commencement of litigation. Why shouldn't the party, who's an interested party in the case, a beneficiary who pursued this litigation and prosecuted the claim, be entitled to the recovery of her fees in connection with at least those two issues? I'm setting aside for the moment the 5% distribution each year.
Because there's actually a different mechanism for that, Your Honor, other than litigation, which is to request an accounting. And that is where the information first comes up, right? The information about the transfers, when she requests the full accounting and it is provided to her, when she requests it, that is where you would find the information.
So you're suggesting there was no need for this litigation, that her brother would simply have disgorged himself of the fees and made the transfer back to the Charles Trust with no litigation? Because I can tell you the history here doesn't suggest that to me, but is that what you're suggesting?
Your Honor, I can't go into settlement discussions, but of course we tried to avoid the litigation. Of course we tried to settle it multiple times before there was ever even a court-ordered mediation.
But why does there need to be a settlement? If it shows that he wasn't entitled to it, why not just return it?
You're right. And my point being, the $38,000 and the $6,000 were never raised as issues when even reviewing the accounting, even before the litigation, right?
Were they in the complaint?
No. No, they were not in the complaint. No,
well, they certainly got litigated.
They did.
At this point, I'm going to assume that was by consent, because there's a very lengthy order and the district court was obviously interested in the issues.
They did. But part of the question at that point is, and what the focus of the trial was, is whether or not the entire 2009 trust for Phyllis Curry was going to be invalidated. And by that point, the issue is, if we're moving money, how much money are we moving? By that point, it's what is it that the court actually wants us to do? And when the error was pointed out in deposition testimony, Mr. Curry acknowledged that was a mistake, that money should move back.
So was it returned then?
And it
could have been stipulated to at the beginning of the trial. This is no longer an issue, Your Honor. We returned it 3 months ago.
But that's also part of the issue of being a defendant in a trial when the plaintiff does not articulate what their claims are. It became an issue at the trial, and it did not become an issue before the trial, right? So before the trial, we're looking at the complaint and we're looking at the statement of the case. And the issues to the defense and the trustee look to be undue influence and breach of fiduciary duty with respect to inter vivos gifting that Phyllis made during her lifetime to her daughter-in-law and to her grandchildren, and whether or not the 2009 amendments and restatement of her trust were going to be effective. Those were the primary issues. And then once we were in trial and they were going through all of the different exhibits, the petitioner raised other issues. And when questioned about it on cross-examination, Mr. Curry readily admitted, yes, that was a mistake, and that should be put back. We didn't fight it once the mistake was pointed out. And so I want to go back to what is the standard of review, because it's very important in this case. There was a 5-day bench trial. There is a very well-reasoned, thorough findings of fact and conclusions of law by the district court judge, and those are all reviewed for clear error. And where there was reasonable evidence that exists to support the district court's findings, they cannot be disturbed on appeal. And those factual findings, as Your Honor pointed out, have not been questioned by the appellant in this case. They have not been challenged.
Well, and one thing, though, that has been challenged is the denial of any attorney's fees to the appellant.
Yes, the denial of attorney's fees to the appellant.
And the award of attorney's fees in its entirety to your client.
Yes. And on the attorney's fees issue, the law in Minnesota is clear that trustees who exercise their duty in good faith are entitled to have their attorney's fees paid from the trust and to have their defense of their actions as trustee paid from the trust. That's true even in cases where a trustee has been found to be in breach of their duty, which is not the case here.
Which case do you point to for that? Because I tried to read every single case in Minnesota involving attorney's fees and trusts. So hopefully I might have it in front of me.
It should be in the Margolis case, but I will double check. Give me 1 second. Let me get to the spot in my brief, Your Honor.
Actually, it's the Williams case, 591 Northwest 2D. But
Williams involved a situation where the law had not yet changed with respect to trustee powers. And so the court in Williams was careful to point out that with respect to any violation of the trust duties, the duty to diversify was not yet codified. I mean, I think that that's what drove the attorney's fees decision in Williams. You can, or at least it seems to me to be what drove a decision by the court that the institutional trustee had not breached its duty. Right. Correct me if you...
No, I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I also think it goes to what is the standard of care and what are the allegations alleged against the trustee, right? So in cases where attorney's fees have been denied to trustees, those cases typically have found self-dealing, like actual bad faith, self-dealing, neglect. Those are the cases where the attorney's fees to a trustee have been denied. All of the other cases award attorney's fees to a trustee who, in good faith, is found not to be in breach, which is the finding here. Even if mistakes were made, for example, in the Margolis case, there was a failure to obtain an opinion as required under the strict terms of the trust agreement.
Okay, in which, again, you want me to look at the Margolis case from which year? Because there are two. There's a 2009 and a 2007. You must be talking about the 2007 case.
I'm talking about the second one, yes, Your Honor.
Oh, the second one.
The second one.
2009.
I'm talking about the, yes.
And where would I?
At 928.
Ah, yes. But, you know, the facts in that case really have to do with payment. For somebody in a nursing home, and the trustee made some payments that weren't technically authorized under the trust. I mean,
why is that different, Your Honor? And I want to explore what happened here and what the facts are and what the district court found, which is entitled to deference and which is subject to clear and convincing standard of, excuse me, clear error on review. Which is the district court found, as a matter of fact, based on the evidence at trial, that Mr. Curry and his wife Mary and their two daughters had a very close, loving, personal relationship with his mother, Phyllis Curry, and that what they did was take care of her, especially her daughter-in-law, on a daily basis.
And I think the record is clear with respect to that, and I guess what I'm wondering is, with respect to the smallest claim in the case,
yes,
the $6,000 in improper fees, the court seemed to have rejected your client's explanation about that, the fees versus attorneys. I don't know. There was some slicing and dicing, and the court seemed to reject that. With regard, so in other words, it seemed to me the court was saying there's really no good faith basis for that particular payment. What about that payment?
There are two trusts here, the Charles Trust and the Phyllis Trust. The Charles Trust does not prohibit the payment. In fact, it expressly allows for the payment, and that's in Exhibit 11 of the trial exhibits. And there, again, it's a small amount, and we saw no point in fighting over the $6,000 and just saying we want to be done, right? So we weren't going to challenge that any further. But the fees, compensation for time spent by Charlie as trustee, is allowable under the Charles Curry Trust. It was not allowable under the Phyllis Trust as amended in 2009. That is correct.
And from which were the fees paid?
I'm sorry?
From which trust were the fees paid?
I believe they were paid equally from both. That is my memory. But I don't have a record cite for
that. Okay, because the court ordered that they be returned to the trust from which they came.
Correct.
Just,
yeah. And the practice of the trustee throughout was for legal fees and then for what he had charged as, well, we'll call them professional service fees for the purposes of this argument, that it was split equally between the two trusts because both trusts were named in two separate actions.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I'm understanding this, your perspective on our standard review. I'm looking at conclusion of law number 37. The petitioner is not entitled to have her attorney's fees from the trust as these did not confer benefit on the trust. So, which it's styled as a conclusion of law. Is it your argument that's actually a factual matter? And what is our, should our standard, whether or not they conferred benefit overall, or what's our standard of view?
Yes, I think that one is a mixed question, Your Honor. I think the legal question about attorney's fees being paid typically is a question of law and left to the discretion of the trial court. I think it's an abuse of discretion standard because the question of attorney's fees being awarded from a trust is typically vested with the discretion of the trial court. So I think that's the proper standard of review for 37. I think it is a mixed question in terms of whether or not a benefit was conferred. I think that's the facty piece of it.
And we're not bound by the label the court gives to the conclusions or the findings in any event.
Correct. You are not, Your Honor. Okay. Did the court have any more questions?
So just to sum up on the attorney's fees, even though there is a return of those sums to the trust following litigation by order of the court, you're saying it's not an abuse of discretion because the court found that the attorney's fees did not confer the benefit on the trust.
We're pointing
because
out,
yes. Somehow they would have been returned otherwise?
Actually, yes. Or that having a protracted litigation like this was, with the different shifting theories of liability, with the different shifting pieces of evidence, did not actually confer a benefit on the trust or the beneficiaries. And in fact, what it did was deplete the assets of the trust for all beneficiaries and to the detriment of all beneficiaries, including the petitioner.
But the court didn't really point the finger at either one of these parties with respect to that. And it didn't actually say that the attorney's fees weren't being awarded because of the depletion.
Correct. But it did find no benefit was conferred on the trust by the petitioner, as is required under the Atwood standard for giving the non-trustee party the benefit of their attorney's fees being paid from the trust.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd just like to address a few of the issues that came up during respondent's argument. First, the discussion about how petitioner could have pursued other avenues to resolve these issues, specifically through requesting an accounting of the trust. She actually did explicitly request an accounting on more than one occasion, and the trustee refused to provide one to her, and then also, as was discussed at trial, sent her what they call a release and receipt, which is essentially her consenting to the distribution of her portion of the various trusts without having provided her an accounting.
The findings contain, one finding is that your client sued in 2009 in order to obtain information about the trust. Is that accurate?
I believe she requested an accounting in 2009. I don't recall that she actually filed suit in 2009.
Okay. Well, I'll certainly go back and look at that.
Yeah. I'm just looking briefly. She was certainly concerned about some of the changes that were being made to Phyllis's trust after the death of her sister Olivia, which was, she died in late 2008, so these changes were being made in early 2009. And I know that she was having discussions or attempting to have discussions with her mother. I believe there were also some attempts at discussions with her brother about it. And I know she did request some information, but at that point was not given information. I don't recall, and I could be wrong about that, but I don't recall that she actually filed a lawsuit in 2009 seeking that information.
Okay.
Another point I want to address is the argument that, you know, the attorney's fees and the income transfer came up as issues at trial and were not addressed before that. This argument that he would have disgorged these fees and transfers if only he'd been given the opportunity, if only he'd known that these things had happened, doesn't really comport with his obligations as the trustee. I mean, he's the one who has all of the information. He's the one who knows that that there was an income transfer made after Phyllis's death in January 2013. There was another income transfer made in April of 2013.
Income or principal?
That was income. That was the income under the trust. The trust provided two sources of money that Phyllis could seek from the trust. One was an automatic income payment. On an annual, I believe the trust gives discretion on how the payment is made, how frequently it's made, but basically annually she can take the income from the trust for the duration of her lifetime, and then there's also the principal withdrawal subject to the writing requirement that we've already discussed. This income transfer was made more than 3 months after, I think it was about 3 months, maybe 2.5 months after Phyllis's death in January 2013.
That's the 39-some.
Correct.
I've been referring to it erroneously as 36.
I think it's about $39,000, just under, is what the court ordered be disgorged. And, you know, there was no effort to correct that, even after there was an accounting, even after litigation began, even after the parties were looking critically at the actions of the trustee taken with respect to these trusts. And so, you know, the argument that if she had requested an accounting and it would have, you know, shown all of this stuff and he would have fixed it, and you know, they were just trying to move things along as smoothly as possible, sort of falls flat when he doesn't, you know, this litigation is going on for quite a while, and there's no effort to reach an agreement on that, to try to correct the error that he admits at trial, and said we have to wait for the district court to say you have to pay back that income transfer that you made after she died.
Okay, just so everybody knows, mm-hmm. finding number 45
okay.
says that your client had to sue the trustee to obtain the information she requested.
Correct.
Nobody's challenging the
finding. No, I believe what the finding is intended to say is that she began request. I think it's maybe a poorly structured sentence. She began requesting the information in January of 2009, and she ultimately had to sue him to obtain that information. He's talking about this lawsuit. He's talking about this lawsuit.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Does the court have any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued. And it is taken under advisement. And we are in recess temporarily while the ITV is set up for our next hearing.